The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. And here's round one, which tests their vocabulary. 2 marks if they get the meaning of the following words reasonably right. And we begin with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is a gibus? G-I-B-U-S. I think rather sort of up-and-coming types might call it a gibus.
That's how you pronounce it, is it? I've never known.
Well, I think gibus is
right. Gibus. I take off my hat to you, Jack, for knowing
how to pronounce
it. Yes,
that's all right. That's good enough. But what particular kind of hat?
It folds up.
Yes.
It's an evening hat.
But not for women.
I don't know. Vestatilli might have worn one.
I still want to define.
It's a gent's evening folding hat.
Just jolly good. It's an opera hat, what's called a crush hat, and you had a lovely gesture in which you knocked it out like a pipe on your elbow, and it sort of expanded like that. Right? And it was named after Mr. Gibus, or Monsieur Gibus, I don't know which, who invented this. Dennis Norton, what is allotheism? A-L-L-O-T-H-E-I-S-M. Allotheism.
A-L-L-O.
Allo.
Allo. Allotheism.
That's it.
Sounds like a sequel to Bonjour Tristesse. Theism is religion.
That's right. It's the worship of strange gods. Allo means lots of other gods, except the god you ought to believe in. So it's worship of strange gods. One out of two. Nancy Spain, what is a pachyderm? P-A-C-H-Y-D-E-R-M.
An elephant, Jack.
Among other things.
Well, it has a loose, hard skin.
Yes.
All over it, you know, hanging in clothes and all that.
Yes. How many legs?
4.
All right.
One of each corner.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted. It's a thick-skinned quadruped, elephant, rhinoceros, hippo, but it was originally any kind of quadruped that had a hoof and didn't chew the cud, so it did include the horse, which is not all that thick skin. And you ought to know that, Nancy. Frank Muir, what is a bitterling? B-I-T-T-E-R-L-I-N-G. Bitterling.
Well, it's a small something.
Yeah.
Like changeling, which is small change. It's half a pint of something you drink with chitterlings.
I hope you wouldn't. You'd choke if you did.
Anything to do with a bittern? Which is
well,
a bird.
Connection with water.
Bittern is a seabird.
Yes, well, think of something inside rather than on top of the sea.
Now, what's inside the sea?
It's a fish.
Yes. Exactly what it is, but what kind of fish?
What sort of fish is it? Bitterling fish.
All right, 1 out of 2, you're not going to get it. It's a small, carp-like, fresh fish coming from Central Europe. Bitterling. All right. Well, before we start round 2, I give each team a quotation, which I want them to write down, and then the 2 women members of the team go on studying their quotations, and at the end of the program, I ask them where those quotations come from. And Dillis Power, with Frank Muir listening, your quotation is, when you come to the end of a perfect day, and Nancy Spain and Dennis, yours is, the age of chivalry is gone. And then at the end of the program, I ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these words came to be said or written, and I don't want any of these answers just yet. And so to round 2, and this is the sort of who and what department. 2 marks, if you get it right. Dillis Powell, Jules Verne, in his book 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, forecast the use of submarines, which didn't in fact happen until much later. I want to know what the name of Jules Verne's submarine was in that book.
The name of its captain was Nemo.
You're quite right.
Nautilus. It was called after a shell. It was called the Nautilus.
You're quite right. It was called the Nautilus.
Captain, a naughty lass.
Captain Nemo. 2 marks it is. Dennis Norton, the names of the 4 fairies in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh, Lord. Mustard blossom? No, it's mustard seed.
Yes.
Peas blossom.
Yes.
Cobweb.
Yes.
And D'Artagnan.
3 out of 4 so far.
I don't know. No.
The last one was called Moth.
Oh, yeah.
Simple as that.
Soppy name for a fairy.
1.5 And that is Ben. What was the last play completed by Shakespeare?
The Tempest.
Yes. Last play written completely by him was certainly The Tempest.
Oh, you mean he might have left a few fragments that, or what? What is you want to know, Jack?
All right, 2 marks.
The last play by Shakespeare was The Tempest.
No, there is another play which was written later, and probably Shakespeare wrote part of it. No.
Oh, that, yes.
Henry VIII.
Oh, yes, I see what you mean.
And that's probably where he collaborated with Fletcher, and that came out in 1613, whereas The Tempest was 1611. Frank Muir, the names of Peter Rabbit's 3 sisters.
Oh, it was Goneril. Bathos, and the one who's married to Billy Wright. I was rereading my Beatrice Potter recently. Mopsy, Flopsy, and Cottontail.
Well, right, 2 marks. Well, the next round is origins and derivations of words or phrases. These are phrases in fairly common use. I want to know first what they mean, and second, how they originated. Beginning with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is a Jeroboam and why is it so called?
It's a very large bottle.
Yes, how large?
Wait a minute now. A magnum is 2
yes.
bottles. The Jeroboam is 4.
You've forgotten the tappet hem.
Beg your pardon?
You've forgotten a thing called the tappet hem.
I never heard of it.
Well, it comes in the middle between what you're talking about.
Well, it's 8 then. I settle for 8.
Settle for 8 is fairly right. It's yes. A magnum is 2 bottles. A double magnum, that's 4 bottles, is a tappet hem. And usually, a Jeroboam is 8 bottles. It's a double magnum, though one of the great wine experts, Saintsbury, says it's 6 bottles, and there's a heretical tribe that thinks it's 12 bottles, so it's all a bit confusing. Now, why was it called Jeroboam? You've got 2 of your marks.
It's after Jeroboam in the Bible.
Yes, and why?
He did everything very sort of mightily.
That's it. Quite right. 4 marks. Jeroboam in the Book of Kings was described as a mighty man of valour, and then a bit later on it says, and he made Israel sin. 4 marks. Well done. Dennis Norton, why is a cab called a cab?
Well, a cab is called a cab. Cabriolet. Yes, after cabriolet.
Yes.
Cabriolet is a French word, and it means coffee with a lot of milk. It's a type of French carriage that goes along.
Understand. All right. Just a bit further on. How many wheels and how many horses?
No, I don't know.
4 wheels, 1 horse.
4 wheels, 1 horse, is my equine friend.
I think 1.5.
Well, 1.5 horse.
4 horses. Cab is short cabriolet, as you said. A light 2-wheel hooded 1 horse chaise. Also a motor car with fixed sides and a folding top. That came a lot later. And now, why was it called cabriolet? Never mind.
Well, how far back can you go? It originated in a gesture. If you go far enough back.
It does. You're quite right. Originally, cabriolet came from an Italian cabriolet, meaning the leap of a young goat. And that was because it rode so much more springily and lightly than the sort of 4-horse chaises or whatever they had at the same time. 1.5, I think. Nancy Spann. In the theatre, what is a cue and why is a cue so called?
It's the line before when you come in.
Yes.
What's it called? Well, it's the tail.
Yes.
The tail of the line before.
All right. Cue is the last line of somebody's speech in the theatre, giving the warning for the next chap to start up and make his bit of speech. It's the tail end of a speech called cue because it is from the French word Q-U-E-U-E, meaning tail or tail end of something. And, of course, the same sort of thing as the disconsolate chaps waiting outside the theatre who never hear any cues at all. Now, Frank Muir, why is an atlas called an atlas?
You wouldn't call it a history book, would you? It's called an atlas because it's named after a chap called Atlas.
Yes. What did he do?
He didn't wear an hat.
He couldn't.
He was also a gentleman in Greek mythology who upheld the world on his shoulders.
All right, that's good enough. He was one of the Titans who fought against Zeus, and Zeus condemned him to wearing the world on his shoulders, or the heavens. That's why it was called Atlas. Four marks. The next round is about styles of writing. Two marks. I want the author of these pieces of writing, and I hope you can tell the writer from the style. An extra mark if you can name the book it comes from. Dillis Powell. There's a young man hid with me, in comparison with which young man I am an angel. That young man hears the words I speak. That young man has a secret way peculiar to himself of getting at a boy, and at his heart, and at his liver.
Oh, it must be Dickens.
Tis Dickens.
David Copperfield?
No, not that one.
Oliver Twist.
I can give you two out of three. It's Great Expectations. Magwitch in Dickens' Great Expectations, chapter one. Dennis Norton. The cook was a good cook, as cooks go, and as cooks go, she went.
I don't know from the style whether it's cheating, but is it Saki?
Saki, yeah. That's quite right. Saki. And do you remember his other name, Dennis? It's not essential.
It's in Batchett.
That's right. It's H.H. Munro, who wrote under the pseudonym of Saki, and it comes from a book, I give Dennis two out of three, it comes from a book called Reginald on Besetting Sins, and Reginald is speaking. Nancy Spain. It is happy for you that you possess the talent of flattering with delicacy. May I ask whether these pleasing attentions proceed from the impulse of the moment or are the result of previous study?
I know, it must be Jane Austen.
Yes, it is.
And I suppose it's Pride and Prejudice.
You're absolutely right. Well done.
I suppose that it's Elizabeth Bennet being terribly rude.
All right, I've got to give you three because you've done jolly well. It's Papa Bennet.
Mr. Bennet.
Who is listening to that ass, solemn ass, Collins.
Oh.
And he finishes up by saying, Mr. Bennet's expectations were fully answered. His cousin was as absurd as he had hoped. Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice, chapter 14. Frank Muir. Really, if the lower orders don't set us a good example, what on earth is the use of them?
This is a sort of epigrammatic piece of dialogue.
Yes. Isn't it?
By the gentleman who wrote that work is the curse of the drinking classes.
Yes.
Mr. Oscar Flaherty Wilde.
In
a moment of pure truth. the importance of being earnest,
yes,
is our considered opinion.
Well done. Now we come to the last round. And go back to the quotations I gave to two teams earlier in the programme. And first of all, Dennis Power, for two marks, I'd like the origin of your quotation, when you come to the end of a perfect day.
It's a popular song about the time, I should think, of the First World War or something like that. Isn't that enough?
No.
And when you come to the end of a perfect day and the...
All right, half a mark for effort. It's right. Carrie Jacobs Bond.
Oh, of course.
An American songwriter.
Carrie Jacobs
Bond.
Bond.
Half out of two. All right, Nancy Spain. Now I want the origin of your quotation. The age of chivalry is gone.
Well, I think it was a speech.
Yes.
By Burke.
Quite right. But he was talking about the death of the poor Queen of France, Marie Antoinette. The age of chivalry is gone, that of sophisters, economists, and calculators has succeeded, and the glory of Europe is extinguished forever. And I ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation gets the bigger applause from you, the studio audience. So, back to Frank Muir. When you come to the end of a perfect day.
The other day I was drowning. My past life flashed before me. It was absolutely fascinating. I recalled when I was quite young, I'm on the beach at Broadstairs where I was brought up. I used to spend all day in the sun dashing about on the beach and begging for coppers and for a crust of bread, and sometimes some of the holiday makers on the beach would give me a rather old marmalade sandwich down. And then lunchtime the chauffeur and nanny would collect me and roll down. They were lovely, halcyon days. Very gay days. And my greatest friend on the beach was the deck chair attendant, who was a rather large man, rather old man, gnarled. And he had a sort of growth of grey beard. He never shaved until the evening for some curious reason, so he always had sort of white beard, which is intriguing to a child, because I always thought hair sort of grew dark and then went white, and it seemed to me a sort of conjuring trick to actually grow white bristles. I was fascinated. This chap's name was Fig, Albert Fig. I realise now that he was more than influence on my life. He was more than a visionary. He was a ruddy liar. Because in those days when I was eager for word of the outside world, I drank in everything he said. I said, "What were you, sir? Were you a sailor before? Were you a tar, sir, before the mast? Did you lean on the taffrail and watch the horizon for sporting dolphins?" And he said, "No, I was the ship's hairdresser." And then he told me a very interesting story, how he'd almost made a fortune, because when it was a cruising ship and he had passengers, and he used to do the ladies' hair, and this was sort of late Edwardian days, and hair was hennaed in those days a lot, you know, and it wasn't really a totally satisfactory dye, because it used to come off on the combs and whatnot, and he thought if he could find a better red dye for women's hair, he'd make a fortune. The second engineer, he told me, kept a whiskey still in his locker, which he'd made from old bits of copper piping from the engines. So old Pa Fig had got this whiskey still, and he got some cochineal from the ship's galley, and he thought that if he could refine cochineal down, he could make a very deep dye, and this perhaps would dye women's hair better than hair. And he said, "I succeeded in doing this eventually, after many years of frustration. I succeeded in reducing cochineal, in refining it, as you might express it, into a very powerful dye indeed, which worked very well on ladies' hair." And he decided to embark upon a financial career, and he said, "I'll set up a market. I had a stall, and I had me dye there in little pots, and I stood up and I shouted my wares, and I explained to the populace the advantages of my dye over others, over ladies' hair, the fact that it does not mark your comb, and I invented the singing commercial. Because," he said, "I made up a slogan and I sang it. And the first time I sang it, the arm of the law descended on me. I was arrested by Police Constable Atkinson, was flung into durance vile, and I was accused of slanderous libel, of faking, and of purporting to have written that particular line of poetry and song." And what had happened is poor old Pa Fig, he'd accidentally happened on exactly a line from a famous ballad of the time, a line by Carey Jacobs Bond, most of whom some of us know about. And the poor old chap had sung his first commercial, and it had been just like the first line of the song. So I said, "Well, what was this line you sang?" And he said, "Well, you know, I just told him that when your lady puts a comb through her hair and it comes out, you know, all marked with henna, well, she shouldn't use that anymore. She should use my dye. I said, but what was the line you sang? And he said, oh, let me think. Oh, yes, I sang, when your comb teeth are hennaed, have a par figure dye.
Sorry for Miss Bond. Now we go back to Dennis Norden's quotation, which was, if you remember, the age of chivalry is gone.
Well, I shall have to take you to a period of my life, which I'm not very proud of, actually, when I was a professional Scrabble player. It happened at a small hotel in Sussex, where I happened to be staying. After dinner, they used to all go in the lounge and all play Scrabble like crazy. And as I got in through the doors, a strange woman rushed up to me and said, you're just the man I want. She said, you are the man who is on that program, My Word. And I said, yes, with a kind of gallant defiance. And she said, well, then you can help us. She said, we're playing Scrabble, and Mrs. Holcroft James claims to have scored 28 with the word tulp. And we say there is no such word. Could you help us and tell us whether there is such a word as tulp? I hadn't the faintest idea. But I didn't like this woman. I said, very loud, well, of course there's such a word as tulp. I should have thought there was no argument about that. And I realised the whole lounge had fallen silent, and I had to go on. I said, yes, tulp is a... I had a terrible urge to say many splendid things. I changed it to tulp is a many-coloured string. I said, they use it to tie up birthday presents, you see? And everybody said, how do they know these things? They are clever. They remember this. I know he's got a big head, but you know. And so I stayed in the room while they were playing Scrabble, and people kept coming up to me and saying, is there such a word as so-and-so? And I would answer very confidently and completely falsely. And I was taken as an absolute authority, and people, all the women looked at me with admiration. And I suddenly had an idea. I thought to myself, I have become such a constituted authority here. If I could join in this game of Scrabble and get them to play for money, I could knock off a lot of ackers. So I said, how about somebody giving me a game? And they said, oh no, no, we wouldn't dare play with you, you know all the words there is. And I said, oh come, you know, even Achilles had his heel. It was a kind of mythological reference, you see, which was very much in character, this kind of thing. And by the end of the week, I'd won £327. So I upped the stakes, you see, and what I did was, when I played the game, when I took the letters, I just put them into any combination at all and claimed that they were words. And they were terribly well satisfied with this, and I would have come out of it very much the winner until Saturday, when a dreadful thing happened. I was playing Mrs. Trowbridge. We were on the very last knockings of the game. There were seven letters left in the box. I picked them out. I found they were the letters YVAICL. So I looked at them, seven letters. If I could go out with this, I was a clear winner. I made the word civilry. CIVALRY. So she looked at it. Said, I've never seen that word. I said, yes, that's the word. Scores 50. My game, I think that's another £21. Oh, well, tee up, Rhett. And then she did something that chilled me. She threw a dictionary down on the table and said, show me the word. I felt my lips go dry. I measured the distance between myself and the door, but there were 12 women in the way, and their eyes were beginning to harden. She said, can you show me the word written down? I stuttered, and suddenly a voice said, I can. And it was this Mrs. Holcroft James, bless her beautiful hide. She said, you can show us the word civilry. She said, come with me. We all piled into a magnificent old roll. She had 14 of us. We went down to Worthing, to a cinema there, and she stopped outside and looked up. And there was a neon sign. Said, there it is. And there on the neon sign outside the cinema, it said, showing this week, El Cid, the drama of a woman's passion and a man's chivalry. So what did I say? Well, Mrs. Trowbridge had the grace to apologize. She said, I owe you an apology. I said, you owe me more than that. You owe me nearly 125 quid. I'll take jewelry. Well, that was that, except for about 2 hours later, I was with Mrs. Holcroft Jones. We got rid of the others. We were in the rolls. I was leaning back on the rather sensuous upholstery, and I said to her, how did you manage it? She said, well, I was down in Worthing yesterday, and I noticed the sign, and I remembered it. So I said, but how? What happened? Well, it's plain enough. She said, what had happened was one of the letters in the last word of the sign had fused. I said, you mean? She said, yes, the H of chivalry is gone.
Beautiful story, and I hope there's a sequel. And I think by your verdict, the mark goes to Dennis. And that finally brings us to a score in which Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden win by a mark and a half from Dennis Power and Frank Muir. And it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶